It's 8:17. Joining me now on the phone, Summit County Council Member Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Leslie.
So let's talk about that Highway 40 underpass. I mean, your reaction to the completion of it?
Fantastic. I think it's one of the best examples of where lots of agencies got together and rolled up their sleeves and came up with a solution. I think, as Rena mentioned in the quote, it's going to be an important connection. It is now. That East 40 frontage road gets a lot of cyclist use, and of course the wildlife with the fencing that's occurred on the west side of 40. You know, that wildlife proof fence. It's just a great thing. Very excited to see it completed.
So, any instruction and the event that you meet up with wildlife in the underpass?
I think that I'd cede the right of way. How's that? Yield the right of way.
Yeah, I mean, are the animals going to be passing by daily, or do you think is it more of a seasonal thing?
I think it's a nocturnal thing. I think that, it's seasonal as well. I mean, I live opposite Round Valley on the west side, on the Old Ranch Road side, and I can get up in the middle of the night and find a herd of elk in my front yard. I think that, most of these animals move at night, and they, Basin Rec or Park City Municipal has set up some of those wildlife cameras that work on a motion sensor, and they've already seen deer in it at night. But I don't think we're not going to see them during the daylight trying to use that.
Great. Thank you. Let's see. Let's talk about the landfill issue at 3 Mile Landfill then. Kind of interesting here. You'd had a request from Park City Municipal to just delay the conversation on that, but went ahead and talked about it anyway. How come?
Well, we're trying to understand what Bevel exempt waste is and whether it has any place in our landfill, or if this exemption that's granted to certain mining and mineral processed waste, if it can be part of the solution in some of our cleanup issues from the mining legacy. And up until recently, I'd never heard of the term Bevel, and it's named after some congressman or senator, apparently. And we're just trying to understand it, and we wanted to continue to understand it, and we didn't think that there was any point in postponing the discussion. I mean, we just scratched the surface of it.
So this comes.
Go ahead.
This comes back then to the county council. I mean, do you make a decision on it, or is the policy intact and it stands?
I think that before we would allow Bevel exempt waste into the landfill at this point, we would have to do a lot more homework, and I think it's a topic that we want to study further, but right now, it's not like it's going to be on the agenda next week or in 2 weeks, and we're going to make a decision to change it. It's an important piece. It's an important possibility out there for dealing with these wastes, but I don't think that it's a simple answer of just, sending it to landfill.
Yeah.
You see, the Bevel exemption, it's not really based on the characteristics of the waste. It's an exemption that Congress created to benefit certain categories of processors of waste. And there's a fire truck going by here. Anyway, it's not like Bevel exempt waste is really low level contaminant. It could be high-level contaminant, but it could be fall under the Bevel exemption because it was created through a certain process that meets the requirements of Bevel. And so it's not like, do you want to take orange juice in your smoothie? Yes or no. It's more complicated than that. So the devil's in the details.
Yeah, but still, why not allow the city representatives who showed up to talk, or at least give their input? Don't you usually do that, allow that during work sessions?
Yeah, I wasn't chairing that meeting. And I think that part of it was that, you know, we were trying to get over to this US 40 and we didn't have a lot of time. But I think that there'll be plenty of time to further discuss it. And Liza Simpson from the city council did share some of her comments.
During the meeting?
Uh-huh.
The city does have one of those probes that does measure contamination on site. So why couldn't that be used and determine whether or not, you know, it's a low level and allowed in?
We don't even know. When you say low level, it's the question of chemical composition of the contaminants. And it's just not that simple where you can probe it and say it's a 6 and we accept up to a 7 or something. We're way premature to, we don't even know what the standards ought to be, what kinds of waste we ought to allow, even though it's allowed. It's the EPA allows it under this exemption, but we don't know what the impacts of the various types of contaminants would have on our landfill, and what safeguards would need to be taken. And it's not all created equal. And it's not like a thermometer; you can just put something in and probe it and measure it and say, okay, this is good. At least it hasn't been characterized that simply to me, and that defies reason somewhat, since, you know, there's a whole host of listed and characteristic contaminants that, you know, it's not all created the same.
So my understanding is that Park City is offering to pay for half of the cost of the new landfill and asking for just 10% of that capacity in which to put some, you know, tailings. That sounds like a pretty darn good deal for county residents, no?
I think we need to study it. We just received a letter a day or two ago making that offer. Boy, something's going on here.
Where are you?
I'm at the library at a meeting at the Richards Building, but I had to go outside. There's so much noise inside. There may be a news story breaking with some kind of a four-alarm fire. But anyway, yeah, we definitely need to look into that offer, and it does appear like a generous offer.
All right. Let's see. The recommended grants from the restaurant tax and wrap tax, Randy Barton showed up to raise a few points. A few years ago, the allocation of the wrap was changed from 55% cultural and 45% recreation to 50-50. Randy suggested that cultural groups at the time hadn't been notified. Is that the case?
You know, I don't recall all the details. Claudia's memory of it was that we did have public meetings, and then we actually had to put it on the ballot to change. When we reauthorized the wrap tax, the ballot language was the 50-50 split. And so it's, whether we did a good or bad job of notifying things, it was passed by the electorate, and we can't change it without having another election. And I think it has like a 10-year life, and so I don't think there's anything we can do about it or will do about it in the interim.
All right. He also questioned that grant recipients have to present an audit when the grant is above a certain amount of money. He noted, though, that would mean that they would have to spend about $18,000 to do an audit and receive a grant of $60,000, and question whether that really makes sense, or is there another way to take care of what needs to be reported?
I think that would be a bad outcome if we require these nonprofits to have a certified public accountant perform an independent audit. I don't think that I think the most of these are not audited entities, the small ones. So I think he's right. I don't know whether, you know, audits come in all sizes and shapes depending on the scope of the work. And, you know, 18,000 I have no comment on. But the idea that they would have to spend a significant part of their grant in order to get an audit, I think would be a bad policy.
Finally, he noted that sales tax revenues have increased greatly in the last dozen years. In fact, we had like some of the best ever just this last winter. The amount of wrap money, though, hasn't increased. And should we investigate that?
Well, I think the wrap money has increased, whether it's increased. I don't have the data from which he's speaking, but it's gone up every year, whether it's gone up in lockstep. And, you know, the wrap is only on parts of the sales tax. And again, I think it's more complicated than just saying that, than throwing out a statement like that.
All right. Let's see. Briefly, Mountain Accord, the county council planning a work session either next week or the week after that?
We hope to have a session at which we can not just have a work session, but have public input as Mountain Accord gets closer to finalizing the what's now known as the Accord, which is the blueprint. And, we'd like to do that. This is Park City Municipal's holding a session on the 18th, the Thursday of next week, and we want to do the same.
So you think you'll have that on the agenda for next week?
We're working toward that. I'm going to be gone the following week, and I'd like to be there for it.
Your position has been that we should stay with the Accord and gather more information. How come?
Oh, I think that Mountain Accord has brought a lot of attention to a lot of our problems, especially in transportation, and it gives us an opportunity to, if we can preserve in the Accord the strong language that causes studies and practices to be implemented in our county, that it gives us a forum for pushing that along and that we're getting things that would take years or decades to get on our own. And it gives us a forum to meet with the highest level with leaders in those agencies on a monthly basis and to move an agenda along that on our own it would take a very long time to do without being part of this greater project.
Yeah, well, when it comes down to doing studies, though, there's some now thinking that we could do any studies cheaper than it would cost to, you know, be a part of Mountain Accord and studies that would be relevant to the Wasatch Back.
What we're trying to do is define the scope of the studies ourselves and have Mountain Accord put us in the driver's seat on those to make sure that we get the right information. And as to the cost, you know, that remains to be seen. In the end, we won't do it if we don't think it's in our interest. And we think that we can make it in our interest, but therein lies the test. Whether we, you know, in the next month or so, we're going to, the deadline or the goal is to have a Mountain Accord on at the executive board meeting on July the 13th. To agree upon the next steps. And part of that is a program charter, and part of that program charter would have, it's an amendment to the existing charter, but it would have all of these details in it of what's taking place and a budget for it and what the blueprint is that's being studied. And we want to make sure that it has the necessary elements that benefit us. Before we go, you know, if it doesn't have those in there, then we won't participate.
All right. Hey, anything else that you wanted to mention? Any news on what the fire trucks are headed to?
No, I don't know where they went. But, I think that's it. Thanks for your time, Leslie.
Thanks. That's Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. It's 8:32. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. On Saturday, the Park City Historical Society presenting its annual historic home tour, and as part of that, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Treasure Mountain Inn, or TMI. In the studio with details, Museum Director Sandra Morrison, along with the co-owner of TMI, Thea Leonard. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, 18th annual, Sandra. What are you going to be touring this year?
So this year we're featuring the historic homes on Upper Main Street, and we actually have 8 historic homes, and the Imperial Hotel will be open for viewing after the huge renovation that's taken place over the last couple of years. So that'll be really exciting to see it not look like a hotel inside.
Yeah, what is inside?
So it was turned into a single-family residence. Yeah, a really big one on Main Street. And recently, the River Horse on Main purchased it. They're going to open up River Horse at the Imperial. And so some of it's under renovation, but we've got the top 3 floors will be open to the public. Yeah.
All right. So how do you choose what houses to tour each year?
You know, the biggest one is just getting people to agree that they're willing to open the door and let the general public in. And I'm just in awe of the homeowners that say yes, because I'm not sure it's something I would ever agree to at my house.
So, all right. So how does it work?
So, and we like to choose a different area of Old Town each year and keep the houses close together. So it's not a very long walk. So it's, you know, all the houses are in a very small area. So we'll start at Treasure Mountain Inn. And of course, Thea and Andy have generously opened that up for us. So come see the 50-year-old Utah's first condominium project. In fact, I understand the attorney that wrote the condominium legal descriptions and bylaws that's the standard that's been used across the country ever since. So that's here we were in Park City, setting history yet again.
Yeah. Just can't keep us down.
Well, we'll just talk about the TMI in just a minute here. So the things meet at TMI starting at 10?
10 o'clock,
and then
yes.
You have
and
until
so,
3?
So you take your own time. We have volunteers in each of the homes. So we give you a program with history. We give you a map. And so you can just stroll the street. Most people spend an hour. Some people spend a lot longer. Yeah, and then at 1 o'clock we'll have a program at Treasure Mountain Inn, and of course we close the tour at 3. So, you know, 2 o'clock's about the latest that you should arrive to get a good look at all of the 8 homes.
All right, and the cost of the tour is?
So it's, I think it's $20 and $15 if you're a member, you get a discount. Yeah. And so, yeah, feel free to join the museum, because of course then that gives you year-round free admission to the museum as well.
Great. So, Thea, you've been co-owner of TMI for how long now?
Well, my dad bought his first unit there in 1980. So it's kind of been a long time.
About half, at least half of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I bought my first unit there in 1989. And then we put the rest of them together. And we've had to sell off part of our ownership to do the remodels over the years. So at one point we owned as much as 50%. Now we're down to about 30%, Andy and I. And then we're helped by a bunch of other owners who own individual units in the property by following our lead.
All right. Well, as Sandra mentioned, it's the first, Park City's first condominium unit. Tell us a little bit about the history that you know of it.
Well, what I know, and it's unaudited information, so take that under advisement, but we understand that, like many big ahead of their time projects in Park City, Treasure Mountain Inn developers ran out of money. So they started doing some trade. In fact, we ran into Jim Gaddis, who did some trade with the units at Treasure Mountain Inn. For a while, they were like baubles or wampum currency. But we understand that the Romney family got a unit, at least in part, in exchange for some legal work they did. The Kearns at one time had an interest there. We don't know exactly why. Hearst, I think. So some power hitters back in the day, you know, had an interest there. And we sort of feel like there's really not a lot of, there's not a thread of audited information that we can follow. But what we do know from, Andy sent me with some clippings from when it opened. And so I guess Dewey Anderson was kind of the engine behind the whole thing. I guess it was his baby and brainchild. And he arranged to have some artifacts from from some more historic homes down in the valley, salvaged. Apparently, some of them are from an opera singer's home, Emma Lucy Gaines Bowen, and she donated, or her estate donated, some of the architectural salvage pieces in the property that make it look older than it even is.
So it was built because Park City, I mean, I think, what, in 64? I mean, just the year after Park City opened
right.
as a
right.
ski resort?
Yeah. So Treasure Mountains was the name of the ski resort that the mine company opened, and that was December of 1963. And so then Treasure Mountain, they began construction in 1964. And actually did open, but they had official grand opening was in 1965.
In February. And a former Olympian came, somehow skied down. I was trying to follow the course, but somehow skied down to Park Avenue and then cut a ribbon on Main Street. The guy's name was Dev Jennings. And he skied with some buddies, some ski patroller buddies, with the scissors in his pocket. You know, true Park City, let's get this done and go play. Ski down, cut the ribbon, and I guess he was like, see you later, we're going to go back up.
So was it, do you have any old lodging records? I mean, was it something that was used a lot?
You know, I think it had a brief moment of, like, activity when it first opened. It got a lot of press, like 3,000 or 4,000 people showed up for the opening.
And U.S. Senator Frank Moss
even
came. So it was a big deal for Utah.
Yeah.
They rolled out the dignitaries.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have how many units in there?
There are 56 residential and five commercial now.
Mm-hmm. And so that was the original, though, 56 units?
According to what we see, they increased the number of units over time, maybe to liquidate a little bit more cash than they originally thought. Originally, it says it was planned for 50 residential and 3 commercial. I don't know if they jerry-rigged it along the way, or I'm not exactly sure. Sorry, I wish I knew more.
All right. So and as part of that, I mean, what are you doing for the 50th anniversary other than just recognizing that it's been 50 years?
Well, the highlight of the time should be Tom Clyde showing up to poke fun at us. He's good at that. Or to tell us what he knows, because he was city attorney I don't want to spoil the punchline, but he's got a good story from when he was city attorney. So you should come and hear him.
And when's that going to happen?
And 1 o'clock. And we also have Mayor Jack Thomas, who grew up in the area as well. So he'll have some great reminiscent and personal stories.
He also had an office in Treasure Mountain Inn. Right when I first got here, moved here full time, he had an office there. And then anybody else who wants to come and add to the the lore.
Yeah. So unlike a lot of the miners' homes that were built for a couple of years, TMI, I mean, with its brick and concrete, it was meant to stick around, huh?
Well, yeah, kind of funny story. When Andy and I took my dad out, we had a phalanx of engineers come through to evaluate its, how solid it was. And unfortunately, they said it's going to be the last thing standing in Park City. Sorry, Park City. No, it's solid.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
So I just wanted, to thank all our homeowners. We also have 50 volunteers that are helping us put the tour on, and also sponsors Jones Waldo, Shane Herbert, a local realtor, Zoom Restaurant, and the Park City Chamber Bureau for their generous support. And we have another 20 sponsors, home sponsors as well. So it's really a community effort, and I just wanted to thank everybody.
Okay, Sandra and Thea, thanks.
Thank you.
It's 8:43 now. Good morning. Well, for one more year, Habitat for Humanity enlisting the help of volunteers serving through AmeriCorp. In the studio with me, I've got Lisa Schneider and Jessica Smith with Habitat, as well as one of those volunteers, Griff Alishkovich. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, good morning to all of you. So, Lisa, is this the first year you've used the help of AmeriCorps, or is it something you've been doing for a while now?
We have been partnering with AmeriCorps for about 2 years now, and there are different kinds of AmeriCorps service groups. The NCCC is represented today by Griff, and they come for 6 to 10 weeks at a time and work on specific kinds of service projects and then move on to a new community. So this is our second year with NCCC AmeriCorps program, and we are currently recruiting for 2 AmeriCorps positions that would be full-time for a 12-month service term, and that was a large grant program that we applied for, and we were awarded 2 positions. So we're thrilled. That's a first for us to be awarded a National Service AmeriCorps and a AmeriCorps VISTA position.
All right, so you have those 2 full-time plus Griff as a part-time?
Griff and his 7 colleagues from NCCC AmeriCorps are here until the middle of July, and they're out in Colville doing work specifically with homeowners, owner-occupied homes, primarily external housing projects like yard work and fire mitigation, cleaning up brush. They're working with a lot of seniors who might have a hard time being able to do that kind of work themselves. So they're out there pretty much every day for the next few weeks in the community doing that kind of work. And then the 2 AmeriCorps positions that we're actively recruiting for will be working for a year with Habitat, really building capacity around our volunteer program. So putting a lot of structure and systems and processes in place, that's an AmeriCorps VISTA role. And then the other AmeriCorps role, a national service role, is a construction crew leader and focusing on community outreach around our neighborhood revitalization paradigm, which is a way of thinking about how we interact in community and engage community around various housing issues.
So in Colville, have you already identified the needs then that...
We actually have. So last year with the first AmeriCorps NCCC team, we went out and did a basically what's called a rooftop housing study. And we looked at every home in Colville and identified from the exterior what some of the exterior needs are so that we'd have a data set for going back into the community and being able to say, you know, we know that 50 homes really need roofing help. And then it's a matter of drilling down and seeing if those homeowners actually could qualify for Habitat's program.
All right. So, Griff, why is this something you wanted to do?
So I'm just out of high school, and I really wanted to give back to sort of the community at large, just America in general. I was really inspired to give a year of service and just get some time back to think about my life.
All right. So why did you choose Park City? Or do you have a say? I mean, you just kind of register with AmeriCorps and they send you where they need you? Or
yeah. So once you register for AmeriCorps, you're put in 1 to 5 campuses for NCCC, my particular service-like program. And then once you're in one of those 5 campuses, you get sent to one of their 10 states every single round for 4 different projects that last varying amounts, around 6 or 7 weeks.
All right. So Park City was one of your choices, though, or?
No. So we don't choose. We just get sent to wherever
you're needed. Yeah. So while you're here, where do you stay? I mean, there aren't 10-week rentals.
So housing is supplied by a sponsor, which in this case is Habitat for Humanity. And we're presently staying at the Snowshoe Inn.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So we have a partnership with Deer Valley, and they very, very generously, during the off-season, have made housing available for our AmeriCorps volunteers. It's been a really nice partnership to develop with Deer Valley because one of the issues, as you know, in our community is housing for the workforce. And so we've been able to spend some time with Deer Valley employees during their brown bag lunch series. They also have a wellness program, and we have gone, Jessica can speak to that, and done some educational programs with employees at the resort. So it's been a really lovely blossoming relationship all the way around, where hopefully our programs are reaching more people. And we're learning that many, many people who work here in the resort world just don't have a strong awareness of the kinds of opportunities around housing that are coming up. And so being able to reach them in that way has been an important piece of our work.
So what have you learned?
So, actually next week, the 18th, we will have our brown bag at Deer Valley with the employees. So we'll be going and doing some home buyer education as well as going over the programs that Habitat offers in order for employees to become potential homeowners with Habitat.
Okay. So do you get paid? You may have a place to stay, but do you also get paid?
So we have a living stipend, and we also get a budget for food and a gas budget.
Okay. And that comes out of the Habitat's pockets then?
So interesting. So for the NCCC AmeriCorps program, that grant, Habitat does not contribute financially other than for housing if we need to support housing. For the AmeriCorps National and Vista that we're really wanting to get the word out today about that. So if people are out there and interested in applying for these jobs, they're really phenomenal opportunities to get training. You get a monthly stipend. You get a tuition gift at the end of your service term. You can apply it to your own student loans or future education. Or if you're a mom going back into the workforce or a recently retired person that wants to do something different, you could actually bring your skills to Habitat in an AmeriCorps role and give your education stipend away to a family member, like a grandchild or a child. And so those positions are paid, and Habitat does contribute financially to be part of that program.
Okay. Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Exciting news. So we're in the process of purchasing land in Heber, and we will be starting a build in Heber in August.
Great. One house, single family?
We're hoping to get density on the piece of property and at least do two. So we're working on some density over there. But we'll start with one, and we expect that we could turn it into two if all goes well.
All right. So two houses as opposed to a duplex then.
Well, we hope to do like the Marsac home. Same design. We're still working with Ralph and Nancy Archiplex on the design. And it'll be, twin home type style.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
The Kimball Arts Center is offering yoga in its main gallery tonight. On the phone with me to tell us more about that, I have Simone Olive. Good morning, Simone.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So what's happening?
So tonight in our main gallery we're having yoga with art. It's going to be great. We're going to have the whole main gallery will be filled with yogis of all levels. Practicing yoga. So it should be really fun. It'll be right amongst the art, and there'll be music. It'll be great. It'll be a great opportunity to really, one, see the show that's happening. It's our last exhibit in our main gallery, and, have a creative way of experiencing it through vinyasa. So.
Okay. So you're going to have Katie Eldridge kind of leading the class, and then music being provided by a DJ?
Yes. Scott Moore and Katie Eldridge will be leading the class, and DJ Jesse Walker will be doing the music, so it'll be an upbeat, yoga class, so it'll be fun.
All right. It starts at 6, so get there a little bit early so you can lay your mat out.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, and it's a fundraiser, so how does that work?
It is. Well, it's a donation-based event, we're basing the price off whatever people want to give, but it is a little fundraiser for our education programming. And so we're hoping to get, all of our regular constituents out and some new ones, some people we don't usually touch. So that's our goal.
Okay. People are encouraged to just show up, pay, and then bring their own mat as well?
Yes. Yes. There is, space is limited, so you can register online at the website. And you don't need to pay on the website, or you can just show up, bring your mat, and just donate what you can.
Okay. Simone, hey, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Simone Olive, Newstime, 9 o'clock.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Assemble Park City, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.